all, I just want to thank Doug and the committee for inviting me to speak with you today. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. Today, what I want to do is share with you some of my experience and more specifically the research in helping children and families weather the disclosure of sexual abuse, weather in that process. So we've heard from previous speakers, and they've given you a very big picture of what child maltreatment looks like in terms of working with families and working with systems. And so what I'm going to do in my talk is I'm going to focus very much on the child and parent interaction and what I've learned in that interaction. So as a child abuse pediatrician, I do talk with children about their abusive experiences. And through the years, I've found it very useful to me as a pediatrician to know something about why they told, why they didn't tell, and how long they waited to tell, because that gives me a view into what's going on with their families. And of course, as we all know, what's going on with their families are very key to promoting the healing of that child. So I do ask those questions, I do document them, I do testify about them in court. And in fact, I'm more likely to testify about patterns of disclosure in children than I am about medical issues when I'm called to testify in these cases. So I also use this information to help me plan what kind of social services, what kind of mental health services that our families and children need. In the program that I work with, I'm very blessed to have some very skilled, dedicated social workers, and we spend an awful lot of time focusing our efforts on the mother. Because one thing I think we've seen over and over this morning is the choices the mother makes that really determine whether that child is going to be safe and what the chances are for recovery. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to briefly give an overview of the problem, as I see it, as a clinician, that happens between children and families when they begin to disclose their sexual abuse. The bulk of my talk is going to be about the new research study that we have just completed. It's not yet published, but I want to share those results with you. And then finally, I hope to put everything into a framework to help people, especially clinicians in the audience, use this information to work better with children and families and to help them weather this process of disclosure. So one of the things that we deal with is how does the parent react when they first learn that their child may have been sexually abused? And there's a wide range of reactions, and of course they can have more than one of these reactions. The first is kind of a reaction of denial. And that really relates to, this couldn't happen to my child, it's not my family, or again, not my husband, not my boyfriend, not the child's father. It's just impossible, it's inconceivable. But another reaction is skepticism. It's not possible because I didn't notice any red flags in my child. They weren't sexually acting out. They didn't have pain in the genital area. They didn't have any physical or emotional changes. There was nothing, and yet you're telling me this is going on for 5 years. I just find it hard to believe. And when you take a parent who's had personal experiences of sexual abuse, and she didn't act that way when she was sexually abused, she uses her own experiences to decide whether or not her child has really been a victim. Because are they acting like I did when I was abused? No, they're not. So therefore, it must not have happened. There's also a reaction of grief. And of course, this is more common among caretakers that believe their children and understand that the abuse has occurred. And this grief is related to a loss of innocence for their child, as well as a loss of family and friend relationship. The family integrity is very much threatened. These are the moms that when I'm doing the medical examination, and they're in the room, and the child is doing just fine with my examination, but the mom is crying quietly in the corner because she just could not fathom the thought of her little 8-year-old child going through a pelvic exam. It's just too much. Also is the sense of a failure as a protector. I didn't see the signs. I can see them now that I'm looking back. Why didn't I do something about it? But also, maybe I didn't do a good enough job as a parent to teach my child how to protect themselves and how important it was to tell. So in all of this, there's also a sense of disappointment. So there might be a disappointment the parent may have in themselves, or they may be disappointed in the child for waiting so long to tell. So the child discloses abuse, and they see these reactions in the parent, the most important person in their life. And they see their parent as angry, they see their parent as grieving, disappointed, disbelieving, and sometimes supportive. Sometimes a mixture again. You can have a supportive parent who's also angry at the whole situation. And then it's a question of, are they this way because of me? Are they mad at me, or are they mad at the other person? There's a lot of confusion that goes on. And many times parents are not telling the children specifically why they feel the way they do. So there's a gap, a disconnect. We talked a little bit about the disconnect with Margaret. There's a disconnect here. And it's very threatening to children. I just want to say a word about fathers, too. I know in my community, in San Antonio, fathers often have very quiet rage. And again, it's very frightening to a child to see that. I most often, kids would tell me, I haven't talked at all about this with my father. So there's, an unknown there about how their father feels and whether they're angry at the child. So why is it important to understand something about disclosure? Why children tell, why they don't tell? I think this information can help provide strategies for facilitating and encouraging disclosure. It can also provide guidance in supporting the child when they are making the disclosure. That's a very key time for children. When they're telling an adult that they've been abused, their antennas are out, they are very perceptive, and they're very alert and aware of how people are going to respond. They're very tuned into that. But also, disclosure information enhances the ability to provide ongoing support to the child and family following the disclosure. Helps them, again, weather the process. I'm going to talk a bit about the study that we just completed. So in our study, we had a large population. We analyzed data from 661 children and adolescents that presented either to our emergency department or to our outpatient clinic, which was attached to the hospital, for sexual abuse evaluation. So these were children that were presented for medical evaluation. Just so we're clear, the acute population is a population of children whose abuse, the first abuse, occurred within 5 days. So many of these children were just sexually assaulted one time, or perhaps a few times, but all within 5 days. The age range was 3 to 17. We had a very large range. And I will also say a little bit more about this population. More than half of them have lived in homes with family violence. More than half of them have been physically abused previously. A good number of them, maybe as many as half, have lived in families where drugs and alcohol were an issue, and about half have lived in families or have family members that have a criminal history. So all those poly-victimization factors, and many of them, are in this population. Our average age overall for the total population was 11.6 years. We had 89% female, 7% had more than one abuser. It's probably a little higher than that, but that's how many told us they had more than one abuser. 30% of the abusers were minors. They were under the age of 18. And I guess what was very concerning to me is the fact that almost half of the juvenile offenders were family members. And I know through the years that what I'm seeing is more and more situations that involve siblings, half-siblings, step-siblings in the home. And these are not 5 and 6 year olds. These are 5 year old victims and 13 year old brothers or sisters, which is of course very concerning and another very troublesome family dynamic to deal with. So for our study, we actually embedded the question for disclosure in our medical protocol form. And these were the questions that we were asking the children. And again, these questions were helpful to us for medical diagnosis and treatment. What kept you from wanting to tell right away? We didn't say, why didn't you tell? Because we were afraid how children would perceive that. We asked them, what kept you from wanting to tell right away? Why did you decide to tell? How old were you the first time it happened? How old were you the last time it happened? And how old were you when you told? because there were some children disclosing abuse that happened 7 years ago. And that was another interesting group to look at. Did anyone say anything to you about telling? And again, what we're trying to get at here is that how many of these kids were actually threatened? How many of these kids were told, don't tell or this will happen? So this is what we found. When we look at the total sample, the combination of acute and non-acute, the average time to disclosure was 1.5 years, with a median of 90 days. When we looked at just the non-acute group, of course, the average was longer, 2.3 years with a median of 18 months. It's a long time. And again, I think community members, I think jurors and judges and people like that need to know that kids wait years to tell, but that's not uncommon. We looked at factors that impact the time to disclosure. The single factor that prolonged disclosure the most was a parent's abuser. So if the father or mother was sexually abusing the child, that actually prolonged the disclosure the most. We found that children waited longer if they had family member perpetrators as opposed to non-family member perpetrators. They also waited longer if they had adult perpetrators as opposed to juvenile perpetrators. We also found some very interesting things that we haven't really processed yet in our ethnic group breakdown. San Antonio is largely a Hispanic community, and all its study population reflected the distribution of ethnicities in our community. Hispanic children waited the longest. In fact, they waited 13 months longer on average than our African-American children. Non-Hispanic white children were in between African-American and Hispanic. Our African-American children waited the shortest. And about half of our African-American children were actually in that acute group. So it raises questions about what children, what kind of messages they get with self-protection and telling at home with their families. We also found that the younger the child was when the age of the first abuse, the onset of abuse, the longer the disclosure period was. So we kind of divided this up into three age groups. The 0 to 5, the abuse started at 0 to 5, abuse that started from 6 to 10, and then the abuse that started after age 10. And of the children that were 0 to 5, they waited a year longer than the kids whose abuse started from 6 to 10, and they waited 2 years longer than the children whose abuse started after age 10. This is sort of contrary to what some of the previous research has shown, but in our study, we found no correlation at all with prolonging disclosure among children who had more severe abuse. And what we defined as more severe abuse was that if they had sustained penetrative acts of trauma, there's some type of penetration, and we weren't talking just hands, we were talking genital to genital type of penetration, that did not impact time to disclosure. So it's traumatic for these kids, and their disclosure is prolonged regardless of the type of abuse. We also asked questions about self-blame. I'll talk a little bit about self-blame in a few slides, but that has become an important parameter for us to query because it tends to, in our population, connect to the number of trauma symptoms that children have. We did not find, however, any correlation between a child saying, yes, I feel like the abuse was my fault, and time to disclosure. It did not impact time to disclosure, and nor did we find an association between gender and time to disclosure. Some of the most important lessons I've learned have been directly from the children that I've spoken with through the years, so I wanted to also share some of the things they've said to me that really demonstrate some of the points I hope to bring to you this morning. So this is from Lauren, age 14. I didn't want to tell because when I told the first time I was abused, it ruined everything. It took all my mother's happiness away. Okay. So first we want to look at, why didn't you tell? What were the reasons why you didn't want to tell at first? What kept you from wanting to tell? And what we were able to identify in this sample of about 660 kids are five theme groups. First theme group was fear of consequences. Second was incapacitating feelings. Then lack of opportunity or person to tell. Told not to tell. And didn't know or think it was wrong at the time. So far and away, the most common response or reason why children did not want to tell was fear of consequences. And what was very interesting about this is that actually very few children were explicitly threatened. They were more likely to have a perceived threat. I was afraid if I told this would happen. And of course, the perceived threat comes from observing things in their environment. And when they have violence in the home, they feel threatened. They think that that's the response to whatever I say. The other thing that was very interesting about this is that fear of consequences is more likely to relate to fear of consequences for other people, not for themselves. And I do say this, but victims are very good at thinking about everybody else but themselves, so they come last. And that's what we found in our data too, because the fear of what was gonna happen, of how others were going to react, especially their parents, was so key and such a central theme to the research that we did here. So fear of how others will react, especially parents, this group waited longer than any other group to disclose. Fear of consequences to self or other, including the abuser, was also there. And so remembering that children are often very ambivalent, that even though what they've suffered is horrendous, they often still love that person. And being able to be ready to hear that as clinicians is very important. And then some of the quotes here that kind of demonstrate the theme of fear of consequences. I thought it would hurt my mom. I thought, and that's the only reason I didn't tell, because if I let him do it to me, then he didn't hurt my mom. So the children are perceptive about how sexual abuse modifies this individual's behavior, particularly if it's an individual in the home. They're very perceptive. It's interesting, when I ask kids, I say, do you think you did this to anybody else? They often will say, no, it's impossible, because I always made sure it's with me and not my sister. And so they actually begin to see their sexual abuse as a way of protecting the siblings in the home. I was scared of being punished. I didn't want them to get in trouble. I didn't want to hurt mom's feelings. I was afraid no one would believe me, and my aunt didn't. Fear of not being believed is also very important to these children. So fear of consequences and incapacitating feelings together made up a significant majority of the responses we got to this question. Incapacitating feelings. So these are the kids, and sometimes you talk to them, but when they start to talk about the abuse, you can see them playing it in their head, but they can't get the words out. And for many of you who are better at this than I am, it seems like they're dissociated. But they also just have these overwhelming, incapacitating, awful feelings of shame, of embarrassment, of guilt. They often say, I don't want to talk about it anymore. I don't want to go there anymore. They just haven't found a way to put it out there. And then unspecified fear, just simply, I was scared, I was afraid. Very impactful quote for me. This is a young lady I actually met a number of years ago. I was asking her, what did you notice about how it felt? And what I was really looking for as a medical professional was whether she had any symptoms of bleeding or pain associated with the abuse. But this is the answer she gave me when I asked that question. I felt like screaming, it hurt, but it was like I was in a dream. You try to move, but you can't. You open your mouth, but there is no sound. You can't scream when you're dreaming. Less common categories of why they delayed in disclosure include lack of opportunity or person to tell. So I didn't know who to tell. And I thought this is an important category, even though it pertained to a minority of our group, because this implies that if we give them the right person, if we give them opportunity, and we're better at showing them the person and the opportunity, maybe they will tell, and maybe they'll tell sooner. I didn't know how to say it, how to tell mom and dad that a person we trusted hurt me. I didn't have anyone to tell because I'd run away and I was alone. Or lack of prior protective response. Children that tried telling before that didn't work. I didn't think mom would do anything. He would get drunk and beat her and he would leave, but she always took him back. So what was the point? They're watching. And they're very much their way in these decisions through time. And when things like this happen, it tells them it's useless. It's useless to tell. And then there was another group that just didn't tell because they were told not to tell. It wasn't particularly a threat. It's just that they were a child and the adult said don't tell, so that's it. They didn't tell. And then finally, didn't think, didn't know it was wrong. And while this group was, a lot of them were adolescents who, you know, met up with somebody online through social media, or perhaps a 15-year-old having a relationship with a 38-year-old teacher, like the child I saw last week, and they didn't know it was wrong. But it came to them later that it was wrong, and they told because they needed help. But then it's also a category that pertains to a lot of the sibling situations that I see. He would do it so much, I thought what we were doing was something normal. And at first I didn't know it was wrong. So sometimes they don't know it's wrong, but then they learn something that tells them, yes, it's wrong, and yes, you should tell. And that's what Emily experienced when I met her. She said, I didn't tell because he told me not to, and my mother told me to trust him. So I did. I didn't know it was the wrong thing. In health class, they told us it was the wrong thing and that it was important to tell. Now, she's 12 when she learned that. So it's not just younger kids, it's older kids as well. So now let's look at the theme for why did you tell? So the good news is that when we look at all the themes, there are actually the external factors, which are the factors we can modify, were more common than internal factors. And our external factors were kind of divided among three themes. Found the opportunity or person to tell, it was witnessed, rescued, or somebody else told, needed help from others because of physical, psychological, or behavioral symptoms or concerns. So when you look at that last group, these are the teenagers who say, I was crying all the time at home, I was upset at school, my friends were asking what was wrong, and I finally told. So paying attention to these types of behaviors and asking and being supportive and giving them the opportunity and right person to tell makes a difference. The other thing that's very interesting to me is the number of kids that told. They didn't tell, but actually their friend told for them. So they're telling peer groups, and the peer groups are telling the adults because they are learning from programs, from media, from wherever, that's important that disclosure needs to be made. And then finding the opportunity or the person to tell, this is usually in the context of discussing a related topic with a friend or a relative. And in this case, it was her grandmother. The night before, my grandmother was talking about something similar that happened to her when she was little. Or the doctor asked me. We only had one of those. But again, I like to make that point because I think a lot of times as physicians, we don't ask. It's not the happy side of pediatrics, but it is something that we do need to ask more often, particularly when children present in clinical settings with these behavioral, emotional, or physical complaints that may suggest sexual abuse. The internal factors were less common, but within this group, the most common overall theme or why they told is something that we call the pressure cooker effect. I wanted to get it out. It was like a soda can just shaking and shaking. The pressure builds up, the cup is getting fuller and fuller, and one day it just overflows. So it's more of an internally driven factor. The right thing to do because it was the right thing to do, just knowing that if I didn't tell, other people could get hurt and he would get away with it. You know, this is an important message to get out there, because kids are thinking that they're the only ones in the world being sexually abused. But when they realize that oftentimes sex offenders are abusing other kids, that can be the impetus for disclosure. And when we look at this group, the right thing to do, this group had the shortest disclosure time of all external and internal factors together. So, and again, I think they get that message from their family environment, and they learn that. So it's an important one to get out there. Felt safe. I told because my mom left him. So our next step is what happens after they tell. I don't know if my mom believes me. At night, everyone is crying. My mom doesn't know who to believe, and my little sister and brother cried at their father. You know, the paradoxical responsibility that an 8-year-old child feels for keeping her family together with her disclosure or her recantation. So this is a tremendous pressure, and this is something that happens very commonly, even when mom does all the right things. When she says, okay, I'm not gonna allow him in the home, she follows the safety plan, but she still loves him. And the actions speak louder than words to these children. And they often will recant when they are faced with those pressures. So what does the mom do when her child discloses abuse? And this is kind of a good news, bad news mix. This pertains specifically to situations where there is a family member perpetrator. So 60% do the right thing. They believe, they support their child, they report promptly to authorities. 20% flat out don't believe the child and don't report, and about 20% are on the fence. They kind of want to keep everybody, and they're not making choices. And sometimes these are the families that when they come in for a medical exam, it's like, okay, if there's medical evidence, then I'll believe my child. But if there's no medical evidence, then I'm going with him. And of course, in most examinations, over 90% of them are going to be all absolutely normal. It's not going to be any medical evidence for the sexual abuse cases. So I wanted to talk just one slide about abuse-specific self-blame. In our group, about half of the children had abuse-specific self-blame. So when you think about what Uncle Joe did, do you ever feel like any of that was your fault? That was a question we would ask. It did not impact time to disclosure. Kids that didn't have blame, or as likely as kids that did have blame, they had the same time disclosure. But those that blamed themselves because they didn't tell sooner had very long disclosure time. So you can have self-blame because you think the abuse happened because of you, but a lot of these kids have self-blame because, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. That's how they felt. I didn't tell after the first time, so now it's my fault because I didn't tell. Again, I mentioned the self-blame issue is important to us in our clinic because we found that when kids had self-blame, they had a significantly greater number of trauma symptoms than children who did not have self-blame. The other thing about self-blame that we found is that if parents didn't believe their kids completely when the child made the initial disclosure, the children were more likely to have self-blame. So that initial parent response to the disclosure is key to that child's self-blame, and therefore, at least in our clinical setting, to the trauma symptoms that they develop. So this is the mountain range, and the mountains here in this slide represent different degrees of stress that children may experience following their disclosure. And of course, the mountain range has different mountain altitudes as we go along for different kids in different times and places. In an earlier study, we found that kids would tell another kid first before they tell an adult, so that's the first couple of mountains that you see up there. Then when they tell the adult, for most kids, that's the highest mountain of stress. Then there's a reactive family stress that occurs afterwards as the perpetrator's family. Sometimes there's violence that erupts between the victim and the perpetrator family. So that can take all kinds of forms. Then there can be a child protection worker that gets involved, and But child trying to understand, does that mean I'm in trouble? How does that work? Doctors, they're worried about the visit. Will they get a shot? Will it hurt? It will be embarrassing. Police and trying to understand what their role is. In Bexar County, I'm sure it's probably better here, but it takes about 2 years for one of these cases to go to trial. So those of you working with the family in the interim, every time they get a subpoena, that the trial's gonna go, and then it's reset. It's reset an average of 7 or 8 times. So they're going through these stresses. So it's not the end of it. Sometimes there's a second kind of hell that happens for these families once that child has made the disclosure. I like this quote, kids think of everything they can to try to keep their family together. And this was one girl's solution. I want to go back to him. Maybe if he just took lots of cold medicine at night, he would just sleep instead of touching me. And finally, kind of putting this together, what are some practical tips that we can take as clinicians working with families and children in the context of sexual abuse? There is no normal disclosure. I think a lot of community members, I think parents, they all have expectations about when a child should tell, why they tell, and what is going on with the disclosure process. And we have to throw that out the window. Every child is different, every situation is different. And the more that people understand that, I think the better the child would be in the end, is to try to accept that. In our study, we found that the young age, family member perpetrator, and ethnicity were factors that were associated with longer disclosure times. We did note that children have many different reasons for disclosure and non-disclosure. Disclosure is a process, not an event. Children tell a little, they might tell more, they might take it back, they might recant. It all depends on what is going on in their family and what is going on in their life. And understanding that process is key for families. It's also key when we go to trial. I know in a case that I testified in last week, it involved several girls that were sexually abused by a foster dad through a long period of time. And one of them gave a very detailed history to me 6 years ago about what happened. She's totally incapacitated now to get on the stand. And so helping the jury understand that there were a lot of mental health issues that resulted from that, and it really incapacitated her, that was a very much a key piece for them to know. It didn't invalidate her original disclosure. So it's likely that the reason for recantation and partial disclosures are very similar to the reasons we found for initial non-disclosure. That initial response of the parent is so key. What children need to know is that parents will believe and support them if they disclose. That's the piece they're weighing. They're weighing all these factors all the time, but that's probably one of the most key pieces they're thinking about. And remembering that fear of the parental response is the single most common reason kids don't tell. They're not worried about themselves, they're worried about how the mom and the dad are going to react. Delay in disclosure is common, long, and doesn't mean that children don't love or trust their parents. And I would tell the moms, I say the reason she didn't tell you is because you are the most important person in her life. And she didn't want to hurt your feelings. It's not that you're not close. And you know, that goes a long way because parents feel like they failed. When you tell them that, it becomes easier for them to understand. Most children have no physical or emotional behavior symptoms in the whole realm of things. They don't come in with sexual behavior. They don't come in with genital pain and bleeding. So it is a hidden problem. It depends on the child's disclosure or history. So, bridging gaps. Remember that the child perception of the parent's belief and support is key, and that they often misinterpret the parent's anger, despair, or silence. And they see things that go on, and those actions do speak louder than words. So reminding families of this is important. Mothers need to sit down and talk with their kids about what they're feeling, when they're crying, they need to know that they're crying because they're hurt for their child. I think that's very important because children get scared by that. Children feel responsible for their parents' emotions following the disclosure and thereafter. Often the best sense of security is normalcy. So I know that parents have different responses to this, but for the kid, they just want to know that the rest of their real world is not going to go away. And the parents need to leave the parent hat on. I do tell parents this a lot because they're trying to investigate, they're trying to interrogate, and that is not really their role, and more importantly, it's not what the child needs right then. Emotions and behaviors sometimes worsen or develop after disclosure. So we do try to have families be aware of that and be very vigilant and attentive to it. So that's it. I guess, do we have just a few minutes for questions?
I think we'll hold them.